I'm very pleased to welcome to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Michael.
Martin, it's about 8:30 Friday morning Fremantle time. At 3:30 a.m. tomorrow morning Fremantle time, it'll be 11:30 a.m. in Alaska on Friday. And Presidents Putin and Trump apparently are going to be meeting. And President Trump says he'll know within 2 or 3 minutes whether anything's actually going to happen. Well, that's the last thing he said. He may well say a lot of other things before the 11:30 Friday morning Alaska time meeting. But I have to tell you, Martin, I'm totally bored by the whole thing.
I find it entertaining. It's like a you never know, because the thing about Trump is the narrative always changes. So initially the meeting was going to be this bold exercise that would sort everything out. You know, we'd land swap, and he was already talking about the plan. Then it realized that the plan was deeply unpopular in Europe, and I think he backtracked a bit, and then he's lowered expectations. Oh, look, it's just a get to know you exercise, and I just want to see if you're serious, and then we'll bring the Europeans and Zelensky in. You know, it's been a moving feast, as it often is with Trump.
Well, it wasn't wasted on any of us who are a little bit older who know these things for some reason, that Alaska once belonged to Russia. And it's just a, you know, it's just a little bit further than it is from Fremantle to Rottnest to get from Russia to Alaska. And Putin doesn't have to cross anyone else's country. He doesn't have to worry about security. He can just turn up and probably will claim Alaska back. But he certainly has pointed out that they did the deal in the 19th century. They sold it to the US, and there's no reason why they can't do deals for money or for agreeing to stop firing cannons at Ukraine. But do you have any confidence that anything, Barton, will happen as a result of this discussion?
Well, I guess the only thing that I could think of is that Trump has invested a fair amount in getting this one-on-one meeting with Putin. So I think he'll be keen to have something to show for it, even if he's lowering expectations. His latest thing is that he's pushing for another meeting. He's hoping Putin's at least going to play ball, another meeting that might include European leaders and Zelensky. But for Putin, there's a lot of political capital in meeting Trump. There's not so much political capital in meeting Zelensky, who is demonized as a fascist and illegitimate and a dictator and all of these things. And certainly Putin does not regard Zelensky as an equal.
Well,
So, yeah.
yeah, all right. Well, as I say, you haven't convinced me. I remain bored. So let's talk about something that might be productive, Martin. Might be, although I'm not sure about this either. The upcoming Australian Productivity Roundtable starts on the 19th, runs for a couple of days in Canberra. You know, people say it's shaping up to be a major forum for economic reform in Australia, but it's taken me back to the Bob Hawke days in the 40 years ago, and they were having summits on all sorts of topics and brought the unions together, and capital and labour sat down and talked. There were a few good things that came out of it, I think. But what about this Productivity Roundtable? What are the hopes, do you think, and what are the possibilities?
Well, this is all about how hard the government wants to go or is prepared to go. They're going to get a lot of ideas coming forward. And we've already seen some of those. Unions have talked about a four-day week. That would be quite a radical, bold idea. I don't think businesses are going to be going for that. There's been a range of changes, as is not surprising, proposed changes to the tax system. The negative gearing has come up, capital gains tax has come up in a whole range of areas. There's a sense that, and people that study tax will tell you that we rely way too heavily on a limited range of taxes, and we're not very effective at spreading the burden for revenue effectively across a number of different areas. If they're really bold, they could consider that. But tax reform is hard work, because any person that's worse off is going to be much more loud in their voice than people that might actually benefit. So I think that that's going to be tricky. There appears to be a difference in ambition between the treasurer and the prime minister. So keep an eye on that. Certainly, the summit was called by the treasurer. The treasurer's passionate about it. He wants to consider some of these ideas. The prime minister is keener to stick to his mandate.
A little bit of like playing Keating to Hawke, playing Chalmers to Albanese, do you think?
Not a bad analogy. Yeah, we know that Hawke was popular and he liked being popular, and he tried to keep as many people on side. Keating didn't have such qualms. He wanted to see reform. He was prepared to stick his neck up at times and push it through. And he did push it through, some of those through as treasurer. So there's some similarities here. I think that Chalmers would like to do more, and he's just got to keep his political antenna on. In terms of how hard he might like to push.
It is interesting. He's sort of ruled some things out already, and that is Chalmers. He had to deal with a leaked paper out of Treasury, which Susan Lee, the opposition leader, said, well, what's the point in meeting? It's already been worked out what you're doing and not doing. But the topics are still there. I mean, technology and AI, tax reform, you've mentioned, housing and construction, if we can streamline things in Australia. Education and the workforce. We need more people in particular areas, particularly aged care, it seems. And of course, environmental regulations are a big issue, and there's still reforms to be made. The Labor government said they'll make them to the EPBC Act. But what do you think the most important of all of those is? I mean, there's a lot of talk about AI, but it's pretty hard to do anything dramatic immediately.
Well, I think we need to remove roadblocks to solutions. So we know that the solution to housing, for instance, is more houses. So I still think housing remains one of the most troublesome areas, because if you can solve that problem, people have a comfortable, secure, and affordable places to live. That then leads to a lot of other health and education improvements, and ultimately improvements in the workplace as well. So I think that's one key area to keep in sight. Understanding the changing nature of our demographics and economy, it's really important. So how are we catering for those growth areas in the economy, and how are we catering for the areas that immigrants are moving into, for instance, providing the right services there? So I think there should be an element of this where we're planning for the future and seeking to be more effective in where we put our resources.
Well, speaking about planning for the future, we've had electric vehicles with us for a time now, Martin. I've got to the point where I'm wondering whether I should be trading in my Tesla Model 3. It's 4.5 years old. It's amazing. And there's always been this question about people like me driving on the roads. I'm not sure I do a lot of harm to them. I think trucks do a lot more. But should we all be contributing to the cost of road maintenance, amongst other things? Should I be paying more by road charges than?
Well, I'm also an electric vehicle owner. I have to disclose that too, Michael. And I do believe that electric vehicle charges should come in. And the reason is that everyone who's using the road should be paying for that service. The premise of the excise on petrol is that it funds our roads. And provided it is actually going to our roads, that for me makes sense. Now, if people like you and I are driving electric vehicles and not paying petrol, then it's probably only reasonable, if it's really well designed, that it captures the amount of time that we spend on our roads. The other thing about electric vehicles, they do weigh a bit more than conventional vehicles. So apparently weight is a factor in terms of deterioration of our roads. So there's probably a couple of good arguments there that electric vehicles should pay some charge, road user charge. I think the reason why they were exempted in coming in is that the government was really determined to make it attractive for people to switch from petrol to electric, and I think that's great. But I think at some stage where the volume of cars is such, we should look at a contribution from electric. That's my view anyway.
Oh, Martin, you haven't convinced me. I continue to be bored about all of these things. I mean, the only thing that interests me is whether Fremantle is going to beat Brisbane Lions tonight at Optus Stadium in Perth. I think they will. And then, I'll remain focused on that topic. I mean, how can you be interested in other topics? I mean, Australia has said they're going to recognise a Palestinian state, and people are jumping up and down. I mean, it's also a fairly boring topic. Palestine, in my view, shouldn't be recognised. We've been talking about it for so long. But is it all just going to fall on a heap because you can't do it anyway?
It's symbolic, really. Let's be honest. Right now, it doesn't mean it doesn't have an impact down the track. It certainly does. But at the moment, we're in a state of war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, and it's very violent, and there's a lot of suffering there. And declaring a Palestinian state doesn't actually change that. That doesn't. I'm not diminishing the venture. I'm just saying aid for people in Gaza, for instance. And some form of ceasefire are the highest priorities at the moment for the people, for all the people involved in that conflict. And of course, the return of hostages as well, because that's completely unacceptable. So those elements, I would think, are at the heart of what needs to happen immediately. And there's the problem that Palestinian statehood brings out all those emotions for people that are deeply embedded in the conflict, and I get that. But I think the most urgent thing is to end the war on the ground at the moment.
And as to that, we've talked about it endlessly ever since Hamas made their attack nearly 2 years ago. And we wonder how the current warfare is going to be slowed down. No one wants to have anything to do with Hamas. All the governments that have said they will recognize Palestine as a state don't want to recognize Hamas. They want them to go, and that's one of the conditions. But how do you get rid of Hamas? I mean, we'd like a company that changes its name. They can now call themselves something else and come back in another form. The people who man the organization and hold the key positions, their fighters, can all go off and join someone else. I mean, how do you get rid of Hamas?
There's a number of ideas around. I don't know if they satisfy everyone. One of those is complete demilitarization. So it would be perhaps some form of amnesty and handing the weapons and at least making the most senior members of the organization disappear. Of course, the difficulty is with a movement like Hamas, where does the movement start and stop? What has happened? What about that 16, 17-year-old that picked up a gun to help? Resist the occupiers. Are they Hamas? There would so I don't think you could possibly eject everyone that's been involved in the fighting, but you might seek to remove the leadership of Hamas at the very least. And they
Mark.
might agree to go because it has there's not likely to be any resumption of semi-normal life under the current circumstances.
At the same time, it's very clear that even more occupation, if you put it that way, more development, more housing, more activity from the Israeli side in the West Bank. I mean, it's almost going to be impossible to recognize that there can be a Palestinian state in the West Bank area.
I think that there are deep problems because of the number of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. You don't actually have contiguous areas that are easy to govern now. Of course, if you look closely at that map, the West Bank and Gaza are not connected to one another at all. And the Palestinian Authority that's been trumpeted as the party of governance, it has no presence at all in the Gaza Strip. Not only that, it would appear that they're deeply disliked in the Gaza Strip. So I think there's still all of those unanswered questions.
Well, Putin believes he's got real control of large swathes of Ukrainian territory and doesn't want to give anything up. And you can sort of foresee a difficult future there. But what about Israel in relation and their attitude to Gaza? They're talking about going in. It'll become a reality whether people complain about Australia recognizing a Palestinian state or not, won't it? What's Netanyahu got in mind for moving in on Gaza?
Well, he's doubling down. I mean, he's got a lot of criticism about the way the war's been conducted from Israel. So, but he seems impervious to that, and he thinks that he can finish the job. by going. He's actually held Gaza City before, but at least held it, conquered it, whatever term you want to use, much earlier in the conflict. But occupying those areas is extremely difficult, and it makes those soldiers very much sitting targets. And given that Hamas has shown an ability to disappear and then regroup, there's a lot of question marks over the wisdom and sustainability of that tactic, even from a tactical point of view, before we start talking about those important humanitarian considerations, Michael. So there's been a lot of reported disquiet in the Israeli military about the approach, and more recently they've come out and said that they'll do it, but I think it's a very high risk strategy.
I mean, it's crazy. Just to remind our listeners, to remind ourselves, the Gaza Strip covers an area of approximately 365 square kilometers. And if you think in the old money, at 141 square miles, it's not much. It's less than half the size of Canberra for people who have been to Canberra. You can fit Gaza into Greater Sydney about 35 times. It's twice the size of Washington, D.C. and a quarter the size of London. I mean, it's this very confined space, and most of it, from what we keep seeing on the television, is rubble. I mean, I just can't get my head around it. I'm less bored about this, but I'm puzzled because I feel totally powerless, helpless, can't see solutions.
I think that sense of feeling powerless and is probably a very common one amongst many of us, because you can see the devastating impact and all the images, and you can't see any solution. Even like I said, the recognition of a Palestinian state doesn't materially change things on the ground. So there's only a very limited number of people, I think, who have any remaining leverage here. One of which is the United States, but there are very few others that could actively intervene now and change this.
I mean, I don't want to sound at all unsympathetic or uninterested, and I don't want to say I'm bored about this topic, but all of those factors make me want to look away at the moment, make me want to turn away. And I suppose I do want to go and watch the Dockers play football. I want to go and see my youngest granddaughter at the school's dance festival. I want to go for a long walk, and I want to make sure that all the succulents in Fremantle are doing well. I mean, is that permissible? Are we allowed to look away? Can we leave all of these things in the hands of our leaders in Canberra, Martin?
There's a lot of media studies about the coverage of war, and on the one level, the direct images of war can be confronting and help us understand its horrors. But actually, it can also serve to normalize, or it can create that sense of powerlessness, where you just get used to seeing these awful images, and your natural reaction is to turn away. And I fear that can be a problem now, because we've seen so much destruction there and suffering that we just regard that as a normal thing for that part of the world. And that would be deeply disappointing.
Well, it is, and I think that's the thing that stops me completely turning away and turning up to meet you every Friday morning to talk about the mess we're in, hoping that you'll have greater insights as you do than me. But and then it just gets worse. They've got over 2 million people residing in Gaza. Some of them may have left recently or been pushed out. They're said to be one of the most densely populated regions in the world. Population density, Martin, is nearly 6,000 people per square kilometre. Now, just think about that. In South Fremantle, if I walk from South Street down to Douro Road and back, and go that way a little bit, there's your square kilometre. 6,000 people living in it. I mean, it's deeply depressing. Can the United Nations do anything about this?
The short answer to that is no. I think they've tried. I think they've issued many, many statements now that I think they have very little leverage in the whole thing. That density of population helps explain the suffering, because if you're undertaking major military activity in a highly densely populated place, what happens? Death, mass starving and starvation. All sorts of, breakdown of services, all of these things are exacerbated probably by the density of population in that own immediate area where the war's going on. And It probably adds to the complexity and difficulties if you ever try to evacuate the population, as has been touted. That would be extraordinarily difficult, not to mention contravening international law.
Well, that immediately makes you ask the question about the so-called Arab neighbors, but the Persians don't consider themselves to be Arabs, I don't think. But what about Iran? What about Saudi Arabia? There's two large, highly influential countries in geopolitical sense in the region. Why can't they sit down and be talking to each other and saying, we'll put aside our Islamic differences and just try and work out this thing for the benefit of everybody? Do they ever think in those terms, or are they just so busy fighting the US or trying to do deals with the US or whatever that nothing ever happens locally?
The Iran and Saudi Arabia are local competitors in the Middle East. They very much are at loggerheads and have been for a long time, and they compete and they use these crises as leverage and tools at times. And that sounds bad, and it is bad. You've got someone like Iran that has been funding not only Hamas but Hezbollah and other militias for a long period of time and deploying them. And that has not contributed to stability. It's done the opposite in the region. And you've got Saudi Arabia that's long had a strong relationship with the US and leveraged that effectively. But also, it's engaged in Yemen and a whole range of other areas in similarly disturbing ways. So far from being actors that contribute to the stability of the region, they've actually made a lot of things worse.
And what about Iraq in all of this? Are they so disabled now that we don't take much notice of them?
Iraq is a complex mix of different tribal groups or different ethnic groups that for which there is uneasy tensions, and they're mostly focused on peace and stability in their own country. And it's far from clear that the Iraqi government even has control over its own over all the armed forces in Iraq. There's still a lot of Shiite militias, for instance, that are in Iraq that are controlled by Iran. So they're in no position to impose broader authority in the region.
Well, Martin, if I were an academic, just an academic wanting to be engaged in the pursuit of happiness, I can't see why I would choose strategic studies slash Middle East as my topic. Is there ever going to be happiness there? Is there ever going to be a resolution? Is this something the world's just going to live with until it eventually goes to smithereens?
Yeah, I suppose it's been a bit of a pessimistic conversation. I mean, there are always green shoots and positive elements. Sometimes adversity brings forward cooperation and collaboration. I'll give you one example. A lot of Western Europe had been fragmented, and there had not been countries seeing eye to eye. The unfortunate reality of the Ukraine conflict is it's brought Britain back into Europe. And France, Germany, and the UK are talking a lot more and acting with a lot more common purpose now. So there have been, sometimes there are some silver linings to those clouds.
Well, Martin, as ever, I'm grateful to you for responding in almost an upbeat way to my pessimism this morning. But I have to tell you, I'm short of being bored, I suppose, on most of these topics. I am feeling totally disillusioned, and I'm just going to say that's it. I'm off to see the Dockers win the footy tonight, and I'll see you next Friday.
We'll see you next Friday, Michael.